This is Regionally Speaking, Reporter Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Let's check in now with Sarah Reese, who's a writer and reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's start out first here with a little update here about the Whiting Metals issues. I guess it's involved a lot of things. Got starting out last fall with a fire, and now they have some real serious environmental concerns other than all the ones that are happening in the neighborhood. Tell us about it.
Well, it's really not clear what's causing swans to die. Some bird watchers have told me that they've seen up to 30 swans out there that have died. One bird watcher shared some emails with me where DNR informed someone he was working with that six of those swans had elevated lead levels in their kidneys, some to toxic levels. However, IDEM later clarified for me that the cause of death of those swans could not be determined because of the level of decomposition of the bodies. So the area there around George Lake has a long history, and there's legacy contamination in the area. The Federated Metals plant there along the shore, there's a landfill where all the materials from the old smelter there were put into a landfill and capped. And there's some different people have different things to say about whether that landfill is working, whether Whiting Metals, which currently occupies about 9 acres of the original 36-acre site, is contributing to air pollution in the area. Whiting Metals, I had a chance to go talk to them, and they do dispute that and point to a number of other reasons for high lead levels in the air. And the city of Hammond, actually, I went out with them on Wednesday with the Environmental Management Department Director, Ronald Novak,
yeah.
And they were testing the soil at the Lost Marsh Golf Course. So one theory the city has put forward is that there was a fire on September 20th at Whiting Metals, and that the lead particles in their baghouse went up with the fire and then were dispersed through the air and possibly over toward the golf course. Mr. Novak did say that the reason the city, although the firefighters were told to wash down because they may have been exposed to lead, the city didn't necessarily notify any residents because there aren't any homes in the area of where they saw the plume go.
Yeah.
So there's that theory, but the city also is looking into a number of other theories, which include seeing what can be done to check the landfill and the integrity of the landfill that's there, further investigating lead levels in the soil. And the city has spent about $32,000 on equipment to test for lead. It wasn't necessarily for this in particular, but they do have this XRF equipment that they can use to test for lead in the soil, and that's what they were using at the Lost Marsh Golf Course on Wednesday.
Yeah, it sounds like because of the legacy problems there in that whole neighborhood, the whole Robertsdale neighborhood, and we know here the branches across Hammond as well as Whiting, that I suppose it's wise to have the equipment if you don't have it, because you may get called into checking some other problem areas out.
Yes, they said that they had been asked by residents in the area just to the north and northwest of the old Federated Metals plant, where EPA is actually cleaning up the soil because of lead in that area. They'd been asked by residents there to come out and test the soil, and so they'd been able to use it out there. And that's another thing, is there's this ongoing cleanup. EPA has cleaned, I think, 28 properties and plans to clean 3 more in the spring because of high lead levels in the soil that they found up there. And it's unclear, really, though. There's other dozens more properties that have elevated lead levels above a residential screening level, but aren't above the level where EPA is cleaning up at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So how those properties will be cleaned kind of remains uncertain.
Well, it sounds like more concerns in the Whiting and the Hammond neighborhoods there, and in all that industrial area that everybody will have to keep an eye on, including the feds and the state regulatory agencies too. I know one of the other stories, and related in many respects to what you mentioned here, is the story that you had out about IDEM and the problems that have developed over time at the U.S. Steel's Midwest plant. Fill us the latest on that, if you would, please.
Sure. So the Surfrider Foundation did submit comments on the permit by the deadline, which was Monday, the deadline for public comment on the, there was a landfill permit for a hazardous waste landfill. Their motion to intervene in the government's consent decree case also was granted. So now they can become directly involved in that case. But essentially with the landfill permit, they're saying that they think that IDEM hasn't moved forward fast enough to correct things at the site, and that some of the documents seem to show that there's hexavalent chromium that got into the groundwater, and that apparently increasing levels of hexavalent chromium in the groundwater have been found in two different tests. And so they're arguing in their comments, which are submitted this week, that that more needs to be done, and that this landfill permit needs to specify more clearly what U.S. Steel needs to be done to fix the problem.
I know that not only we have IDEM involved, we have the Environmental Protection Agency involved in all of this issues there are involving the U.S. Steel Midwest plant, but there's, I guess, an ongoing lawsuit, too, and there's some parties to the lawsuit that have gotten some permission from a judge to get more involved here. One in particular is the Surfrider Foundation. Tell us how they fit into all of this now.
Surfrider, there's two different things going on. Surfrider filed their own lawsuit, which remains on hold. Mm-hmm. And then when the government in April announced that it planned to, it reached a settlement with U.S. Steel and they had a proposed consent decree, there was a comment period on the consent decree, and reportedly the government received more than, I think, 2,700 comments on that consent decree. Surfrider Foundation filed a motion in that case to intervene so that they could become directly involved in the conversations between the government and U.S. Steel on how to correct the problems. So the lawsuit that they initially filed remains on hold for now, but now they can intervene directly in the consent decree case with the government.
Now, speaking of U.S. Steel, what have they said lately about all of this, and in particular some of the latest issues that have come up?
They've said that they have continued to work closely with IDEM to do what IDEM asks of them, mm-hmm. and address the issues.
Well, I guess that's all we can expect to hear from them until something more comes about on that, too, I guess, too. So,
mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure what the timeline is for IDEM as far as whether they're going to approve the landfill permit or not. I don't know when to expect a decision.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like this is another story that's going to certainly continue on into 2019. Sarah Reese is a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and these have been the major stories that she's kept an eye on lately. And as always, Sarah, thank you for spending time with us to talk about them.
You're welcome.
Let's check in now with Lauren Cross with the Times of Northwest Indiana. She has a couple stories of interest here, both, I guess, in a way related to the environment. Let's take a look, Lauren, at the story that you have online and in print about the Environmental Protection Agency is approving the use of an East Chicago site to be able to hold all those pollutants that have come out of the ship canal. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this was actually announced this morning officially. EPA and IDEM, they announced that they were, this has actually been ongoing, in the making for about 20 years now,
yeah.
Trying to restore the Grand Calumet. And so they made this announcement today that they will be using this contained disposal facility in East Chicago. There's been some concerns from the community about using this to store these PCB contaminant sediments in this facility because it's located near two schools. But in the end, EPA and IDEM basically announced today that, you know, we looked at the alternatives after these concerns were made, and we really came down to a decision that, you know, it's a safe, proven, cost-effective way to handle the waste. And the major caveat here is that in order to consider off-site disposal, they needed a non-federal sponsor, i.e. a company or a public entity to finance off-site disposal and long-term maintenance or mm-hmm. capping of those sediments in
yeah.
the river. And they could not find one, essentially. They had approached ArcelorMittal. They had also approached a number of entities as well, and they basically said they were not interested. So this is what EPA was left with.
So have they gotten any closer to finding a sponsor or somebody that will be able to take over there?
So I think for the last better half of this year, they had been looking for a sponsor, they mm-hmm. said. And they actually are no longer looking for one, and they've decided instead that this is the best way to move forward, that they say that it's safe. It's got air monitoring, a slurry wall on all three sides. They're capping the bottom of the canal. And as you know, there's a lot of other safety features in place. But again, the community was very outspoken about this, that they did not want to see that. I think the community strategy group, for example, they had over 2,000 signatures on a petition. State reps were opposed to this, city council, even the mayor, the school boards, they were opposed to this as well. So despite EPA's notion that this is safe, there are still some grave concerns here.
Yeah, you had a chance to talk with Thomas Frank, who's a community activist and very much involved in this, and he was going all the way back to when I guess in recent years here, when the first word came out that the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers is going to have to go in and clean out the canal to get all mm-hmm. that stuff out of there. He's been very vocal about it all the time.
Yeah, he's been kind of on the front lines this entire time, and you know, I think, as he mentioned, this was kind of the line in the sand that they crossed. They did not want to see this PCB carcinogenic contaminants stored here.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate for the community, but I think EPA has tried to address some of their concerns.
You mentioned that this is close to go to schools and of course the lot of neighborhoods that are in East Chicago. Where specifically that you know is this proposed site supposed to be?
Yeah, so it's the 3500 block of Indianapolis Boulevard. So that's blocks away from the East Chicago Central High School, and it's also blocks away from the new Carrie Gosch Elementary School, which, as you know, that's where students living in the lead and arsenic contaminated USS lead site near West Calumet were transferred, I think, in 2016 after the school board voted to close that neighborhood school, Carrie Gosch.
Yeah, that fits it right in there in the area there, just south of where the Grand Calumet River comes through all across mm-hmm. Indianapolis Boulevard and downtown East Chicago. It's right sandwiched in between there now.
So. Correct, yeah. What? Interesting place for a CDF.
We'll just wait and see if there'll be more lawsuits filed, I guess. We still know that the issues with the U.S. Steel over at the Midwest plant haven't been completely resolved, and there are more people involved in that matter now, too. And so I guess we'll see if there'll be some more lawsuits or some more complaints that'll come about as a result of all this cleanup there at the Grand Calumet River, to be sure. So, one of the other stories, Lauren, that you covered as well, too, is following through on, I guess, maybe a continuation of a project that's been talked about even back earlier this year. The city of Gary has been trying to find an appropriate place to be able to create a construction and demolition waste landfill, some type of facility that they can put in a neighborhood that would be safe to be able to bring truckloads of demolished buildings. We're talking houses and all the other stuff of which the hundreds mm-hmm. and hundreds of buildings exist in the city of Gary from over the years. The city's been trying to work this out here, and you mentioned about the fact that there may be a particular project that has also gotten its own notoriety recently that may be in limbo here as far as whether it's happening because of the fact that the city hall still wants to do this other project. Tell us about that story, please.
Yeah, so I talked with the mayor yesterday, Karen Freeman Wilson. I was really just asking her about, you know, where do things stand with Maya Energy? Because as you know, the Gary City Council rescinded its zoning approval for that project on the grounds that they believe the project leaders misrepresented themselves and misrepresented what the project would ultimately be. The mayor actually said, by the way, we are still looking at our own C&D facility, and this essentially would, this is according to the mayor, it would save the city $20 million overall in transportation costs and tipping fees, because they do a lot of in-house demolition projects, and as you know, there, like you said, there's thousands of blighted homes in Gary that obviously need to be torn down, and this could, according to the mayor, save them millions of dollars. And I think about $4,000 to $6,000 per home just in transportation costs alone. But essentially, Maya Energy would have also been handling C&D material. And I think the mayor was pretty clear that if they had known that early on, they probably wouldn't have been on board.
Hmm.
because they were pursuing their own project.
Yeah, I know that even as we mentioned, the city's proposal that came up here earlier this year was not without controversy, that there are a lot of neighbors in the area where they were proposing to build this thing, this landfill we're talking about, are not happy about that.
Right. So this landfill, I'm not quite sure they had an exact location, but I think the controversy was that they were pushing for state legislation that would exempt the city of Gary from a state law. And it's that state law only applies to Lake County, but it requires landfills be at least a half mile from homes. So there was a lot of outcry from environmental activists, from homeowners, from just Gary residents who have lived here for years that have dealt with, controversy with other landfill sites in Gary. They didn't want to see anything else, next door. But the mayor did tell me yesterday they apparently are no longer pursuing that avenue. We'll see how things go when session starts. So.
Well, certainly to be sure here, I think I said this, they may have went back to earlier this year, and we know that the members of the Indiana legislative delegation who are from the city of Gary or represent residents of the city of Gary even held a town hall meeting one day at the Ridge Theater in Gary to talk about this, and there's a lot of discussion about that, as I recall, too. So, well, Lauren, it sounds like we'll have more stories coming out, to be sure, from City Hall in Gary about this and other information, too, as we find out more about this proposed construction demolition landfill site that the city of Gary wants to establish. Lauren Cross is a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. A couple of environmental-related stories to offer today, and as always, thank you for spending time with us to talk about them.
Yeah, thank you so much, and you have a good afternoon.
Thank you. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, we're always thinking of things to do during the Christmas and New Year's holidays. Why not go see a movie? Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson talks with a Chicago film critic and some ideas here.
Christmas 2018, that means family time, traditions, and movies. You know, there's those set of standard Christmas movies that everyone watches year after year, the legendary movies. Lakeshore Public Radio wanted to bring you a list of must-see Christmas movies. And Patrick McDonald is the editor and film critic at HollywoodChicago.com. He is also the chief tour guide of the Chicago Film Tour at ChicagoFilmTour.com and has a yearly holiday film review with his partner called Pat and Ken at the Holidays on YouTube. So, Patrick, what are your picks for the must-watch Christmas movies of the year?
Go back to Pat and Ken at the Holidays. This is a show that I do every year with my partner Ken Candela, and what we do is we kind of categorize different types of holiday film. This year we had four categories. We always look at a version of A Christmas Carol. We also do a classic holiday film. We also take something from TV, and we also like to go delve into the weird Christmas stuff in our surreal category. So just to give everybody an idea of what we're doing, and maybe if you want some sort of alternative view, what I found lately is that, of course, everybody with the Roku boxes or the PlayStation or the Amazon Stick, we all can access YouTube on our TV screens. So a lot of these things you can find on YouTube, including our TV selection for this year, which is The Dean Martin Show, the holiday show that they had in 1967, right after the Summer of Love. And who would be more appropriate to have on the show than Mr. Frank Sinatra? So it's kind of a Smithsonian-era classic, if you will. It belongs in the Smithsonian. And it features Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra's families. So that's something you can get on YouTube. Our Christmas Carol pick was A Diva's Christmas Carol. Originally, it was on VH1 in the year 2000, and Vanessa Williams plays Ebony Scrooge. You can also find that on YouTube. Very interesting little version of A Christmas Carol. For our classic holiday, you're going to have to go to Turner Classic Movies, which they play every year. This is called Holiday Affair with Robert Mitchum and Janet Leigh. And they're having a post-World War II relationship as Lee tries to decide between two suitors for the holidays. It's very charming and very interesting in film history because films are starting to grow up after the World War II period. It's an RKO picture, and they always show it on Turner Classics. And finally, the surreal selection, again, on YouTube. It may be a must-see. It may not be a must-see. But Santa and the Ice Cream Bunny. Now, back in the 60s and 70s, they used to have matinees. And these matinees, a kiddie matinee, you would pay a certain price and maybe get some treats for a bargain. And these entrepreneurs would put these cheap movies into these matinees. And one of them is Santa and the Ice Cream Bunny, made in 1972, ostensibly to promote a movie within a movie, which was Thumbelina, virtually unwatchable, very long in the middle of the movie. And then also Pirate's Cove Amusement Park in Florida. So Santa and the Ice Cream Bunny involves Santa being stuck in Florida as kids try to get him out, and the Ice Cream Bunny saves him. I will not say anything else about this film. It has to be seen to be believed.
It's so bad that you have to see it for yourself to believe it?
Yes, you have to see it for yourself. It's so terrible. So it's surreal. How would you put Santa Claus in Florida on a sleigh, stuck? His reindeer apparently has flown the coop. Who do you have to get to rescue him? An ice cream bunny. So it seemed to be believed. That's exactly it.
That just sounds funny to me.
It's very strange. I love those, you know, Santa Claus Conquers the Martians is a perfect example of a very surreal Christmas classic, very weird. And just, I really, you know, dig those attempts to go into Christmas and make something strange about it. Because, of course, besides being a honorable holiday, it's also a strange one.
So the movies that you and that Pat and Ken picked on the YouTube
show
that you guys do every year, are those what you would pick as like the must-see Christmas movies of 2018?
It's sort of like a variety deal. We review them. So we kind of like, you know, we research starting in September or so. We'll research kind of our categories and see if we can find something interesting. Like when, for example, in the Christmas Carol, Dickens' A Christmas Carol, there's about 5,000 versions of that. So every year we're like, okay, what are we going to... It's not hard to find one. So this year, I just happened to run across the Divas' Christmas Carol, and this is an attempt by VH1 to do some original programming back in 2000, and Vanessa Williams takes up the Scrooge character. And it's mixed. It's not. There are some moments in it that are remarkable, including Kathy Griffith as the Ghost of Christmas Past. But the acting's really off in it. So good music though.
A Diva's Christmas Carol.
A Diva's Christmas Carol. Yes.
Yeah. So give us the rundown then. What are your must-see Christmas movies?
Let's go to the list of what I think should be your Christmas go-tos every year. All right, this is not just Pat and Ken doing this thing, but every year. And even though I think it's been overplayed, I'd be remiss if I didn't have as number five, It's a Wonderful Life. And of course, that is the favorite of so many people. When I was a kid, the PBS station Chicago had a hold of that film when it was in the public domain, and they played it and played it and played it and played it and played it. So, but it became such a tradition on Christmas Eve that NBC bought the rights to it, as has been documented, and now they play it. Although I haven't seen it this year. Have you seen it this year on NBC?
Not yet.
Yeah. I wonder if that'll be on Christmas Eve, but look for it. But everybody also has a copy. So that's a good one on Christmas Eve. Number four is I'm going to throw an interesting kind of new film. When I say new, in the last like 30 years or so, but Prancer. Have you heard of the film Prancer from 1989?
No, I have not.
Now, that was filmed in La Porte, Indiana. Did you know that?
I did not know that, but okay, I find that very interesting.
Yes. So Prancer is about a little girl who finds a reindeer who's been injured, and they find out eventually, of course, that it's part of the team. Prancer, sort of a mystical, magical film around the holidays, very 80s. In fact, there's a scene in the church where a guy is singing. He looks exactly like Bon Jovi. So you can get your 80s fix. Sam Elliott plays the child's father. It's very realistic and very heartfelt. So I think that should be on your list for this Christmas. And that's a good one for Christmas Day. So let's go to number three, one of my all-time favorites. And again, a kind of a modern classic from 2003, Love Actually. Are you a fan of that film?
Love that film.
Yes. Yeah, and now this is, of course, a little more adultish because there's some elements in there that the kids can't watch. But, you know, you're out there and if you don't have children around or something, that's a great one to play either Christmas Day or Christmas Eve. It's just a just makes you feel good, you know?
Absolutely. No, I agree.
So my number two is White Christmas from 1954, the Bing Crosby classic with Danny Kaye, Vera Ellen, and, of course, the great Rosemary Clooney. It's both funny and heartfelt and has great music in it. I mean, it's just something to brighten up your day. It works, again, on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. So White Christmas. I know some people are out there going, oh, I've seen that too many times. I don't know. It's just one that gets me. So do you like that one?
I have never seen it, shamefully.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Well, then you have something to look forward to this holiday season. In Chicago here, they do a double feature at the Classic Music Box Theater of It's a Wonderful Life and White Christmas. It's completely sold out this year. I mean, people just love that double feature. So.
I love that old school stuff. I'm a sucker for that.
Yep.
I love that.
Yep. A lot of people do. And it's good to introduce the kids to that so they can see what people were like in the 1950s. So.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the number one, I think this is an essential Christmas Eve viewing, the 1951 British version of A Christmas Carol. They called it Scrooge. In America, it was called A Christmas Carol, starring Alistair Sim as Scrooge. And you won't find a better Christmas Eve film, in my opinion. It just gives the mystery and the magic of both Charles Dickens' story and the mood of a Christmas in Victorian England in the 1840s. And I think it's not only a great Christmas movie, I just think it's a great film. The way it was put together, they do pad the story of Scrooge a bit. When you go in the Ghost of Christmas Past, you see a little more backstory about how he got Scrooge and Marley together, his counting house. So I think it's pretty much, that's the one you have to put on Christmas Eve.
Okay.
And those are my top five.
Well, thank you so much. You know,
right.
Some on that list I have not seen. I mean, I'm a little behind, but they sound like definite must-sees.
Yeah, there's some good ones.
That's Patrick McDonald, the editor and film critic at HollywoodChicago.com, giving his picks of the must-see movies for Christmas 2018. Earlier this week, the New York Attorney General, Barbara Underwood, announced that the Trump Foundation agreed to dissolve under judicial supervision. Lakeshore Public Radio's Dee Dotson spoke recently with Dr. Leslie Lenkowski, who is Professor Emeritus in Public Affairs and Philanthropy at the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy at Indiana University, about what this all means and what Hoosiers should do before they make a charitable donation. Here's the conversation.
Now, you consider the fact that this organization has been under the microscope by journalists dating back to at least 2016, and I have to start out by asking you, what surprised you more? The Trump Foundation agreeing to dissolve under supervision, or the fact that it took so long?
The fact that it took so long. Donald Trump had actually said over a year ago that he intended to dissolve the foundation. He was then prohibited from doing that because of the investigation of the foundation, and now they've obviously reached a settlement that would allow him to end the foundation. The big question out there is whether there'll be any penalties leveled against President Trump or his other members of the board of the Trump Foundation.
Oh, so we will probably learn about any penalties leveled against Donald Trump within the next few months.
We should see that very, very soon. And the penalties, by the way, would be financial penalties for misuse of the foundation's money and maybe some sort of prohibition about serving on the board of nonprofit organizations for some period of time.
Tax records indicate that essentially the Trump Organization served as a sort of middleman. In other words, neither Trump nor board members funded the charity from personal funds. Rather, it was funded 100% by donors. In a September 2016 article, when asked if Donald Trump was engaging in charity, you were quoted in the Washington Post saying, "Our common understanding of charity is you give something of yourself to help somebody else. It's not something that you raise from one side to spend it on the other." Can you just take a moment to unpack that statement?
First of all, the Trump Foundation is very typical of celebrity foundations, celebrities including successful athletes, successful recording or motion picture stars, and others. essentially they use foundations, or they set up foundations, as a way of receiving a money that they are essentially being paid. So a star baseball player may get a multi-million dollar contract, a portion of which might go into his foundation. There are tax advantages for doing that. There also, you retain some level of control of the use of the money, meaning that you can give it to the charities of your choice. The Trump Foundation, as I understand it, was originally set up as a vehicle to receive royalties from the sale of his book, which was a bestseller called The Art of a Deal. Subsequently, others who for whom he performed services obviously made contributions to the foundation. For example, there's a big gift from the owners of Worldwide Wrestling that went into the foundation, and he did do stuff for them. I think there was some sort of wrestling tournament. So that's not unusual. There seems to be, I mean, if anything, and that's what my quote gets to, there seem to be very little of the assets of Trump's own wealth in the foundation, except insofar as it was money that he'd earned. Usually when a private foundation is set up, say by a wealthy individual like Bill Gates, they transfer assets to it from their own personal wealth. That wasn't quite the case here, or at least it wasn't substantially the case here. On the other hand, the fact that others contributed to the foundation is not unusual, since those others were people for whom President Trump did one thing or another.
Over the last few years, we've seen charitable organizations attached to celebrity names take very public hits in the media. Livestrong, for instance, is just one of a few that have distributed a small fraction of the total funds raised. I believe I read somewhere that of the total funds raised, Livestrong only gave back 10% to cancer research. Do you think the negative publicity of the Trump Foundation will affect the work and reputations of other charitable organizations?
Not really. First of all, you need to make some distinctions. Livestrong is not a good example because it did not, it operated its own programs. And so the 10% figure, I haven't checked that, but I'm assuming that's correct, represented their expenditures on their assets. That's not unusual at all. A university like IU or Notre Dame spends less than 5% of its assets each year on things related to the operations of the school. Usually when endowments are set up, they're really set up to ensure long-term stability for the organization. So Livestrong's not a good example. It had a real program, and the fact that it had a real program helped it survive the scandals involving Lance Armstrong. It may not be as influential as it once was, but it still does important work. On the other hand, when Tiger Woods ran into his set of problems, the donations to his foundation declined substantially. Part of the reason, maybe a big part of the reason, was that the purpose of his foundation was to promote healthy development among young people, and obviously the nature of his particular scandals called into question the sincerity of that mission. So, you know, you really need to make distinctions. In the case of the Trump Foundation, I think the issue, as with many celebrity foundations, is whether he recognized that money in a foundation really has to be used for various kinds of charitable purposes. He has a lot of discretion as to what those purposes are, but you can't, as it's been alleged, use the money really to pay for a membership for your son in the Boy Scouts. So a lot of what he did may be questionable, but he probably has a good argument, and I'm sure his people will make that to the Attorney General, that while questionable, the expenditures were legitimate charitable ones, even if they served his own business interests. The line is very gray here.
I guess I didn't realize that the reports we hear about quote-unquote misappropriation of funds were actual legitimate charitable expenditures. Wow, that is a gray line.
Well, another good example of this, I heard about years ago, a famous basketball player, whom I won't name, created a foundation to give scholarships for young people with athletic promise to go to college. Well, guess who got one of the scholarships? A nephew. Was this illegitimate, or did the nephew fit the criteria for the scholarship program? You know, a good question.
I have to agree with you. That is an excellent question. And finally, Dr. Lenkowski, bringing it closer to home, for Hoosiers that are considering making a financial gift to a charitable organization as the year comes to a close, what advice do you have?
Well, I think people should give to charities with which they're familiar. We know that people who volunteer regularly are more likely to be givers than people who don't volunteer. And I think there's a simple explanation. When you volunteer for an organization, or say a member of your family has benefited from the organization, you have a much better idea of what it is really doing. The problems that arise usually come because people aren't particularly familiar with an organization. Maybe they've heard about it and think it's a great name, or in some cases, maybe there's some very prominent person being the pitchman for the organization. Those are all recipes for problems. When you give away your money, you need to exercise the same care you would when you spend your money on any purchase. Giving is a kind of expenditure, and you wouldn't spend your money, say, to buy a new car because you heard something good about it. You'd want to test drive it first.
And so Dr. Leslie Lenkowski, a professor emeritus in public affairs and philanthropy at Indiana University. He's an expert in volunteering and civic engagement, nonprofits and public policy, civil society and comparative perspective, education and social welfare policy, and social entrepreneurship. For veterans, the Appeals Modernization Act that passed last year, it's kicked off a much-needed change in the veteran benefit appeals process, and the VA is trying to transform the appeals process to make it quicker and make it more efficient for those that are seeking appeals, and make I can also keep up with it, the growing pace of appeals as well as number. We have with us Dave McClanahan, who's the director of VA's Appeals Management Office, to talk about it. Dave, thanks for joining us here on the program today.
Well, thanks for having me. This is very important information for your listeners in the Chicagoland area, and I guess Indiana as well.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of veterans live in the area.
Well, we do, because the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center out of Chicago and its accompanying outpatient clinics include Indiana. In fact, there's one just about 2 miles away from our studios, as a matter of fact, in Crown Point. So we're close by, and a lot of veterans, even for those who live to the east of us directly, are being helped as well, too, even though they may, because of their distance, they may be taking advantage of the service that allows them to be able to see a local practitioner or a local healthcare provider, if need be, for their services here. But there's a new law, I understand, of course, dealing with the veteran benefit appeals process. And tell us first what the problems seem to be.
Generally, what we're talking about here is veterans that have a disability compensation claim.
Mm-hmm.
That's the vast majority of our appeals. It's about 95% of all appeals. So it's generally not a health care claim. It's more of a monetary benefit claim for veterans that have service-connected disability.
Yeah.
And so as far as the issue of why there are so many appeals, you can really look back for several decades, and the appeal rate has always been relatively the same, about 11 to 12% of all decisions that are made. So what happened is as we increased our claim processing, to where we are now deciding every year well over a million claims, you're always going to get that 11 to 12% appeal, and the current system is simply not built to handle that kind of burden. So it was really a process that developed over a long, long time, and it just is not serving veterans well now, and I think we all came to an agreement that we needed to design something new.
Does it seem like that it has turned out that the old process that is being updated by the new law was just too cumbersome, I guess, too complicated maybe?
Yes, I think that's it's too complex, too slow, and I don't know if your listener is aware of this, but on average, it's taken about 3 to 7 years for veterans to get a resolution of their appeal in the current process. So we were essentially just falling further and further behind. And that's simply because of the nature of the system that was provided to us in our legislation, which kept the record on the appeal open throughout the appeal so veterans could file additional information. We'd have to re-adjudicate the claim. And we also have a continuing duty to assist throughout the process. So, again, we just needed to pull it apart and redesign it. And that's what's in this new law that the president signed about a year ago now.
Now, what are the three appeals review options that veterans have if they don't happen to agree with the initial claims decisions?
Right, so that's one of the key features of the new law is it gives veterans choice, something that they don't have now. So, for example, if they have some additional evidence and they want VA to continue to help them develop their claim, they can file a supplemental claim, and we'll process that just like we do initial claims in about an average of 125 days. Secondly, if they believe that there was an error made in the prior decision, they can ask for a higher-level review by a more experienced employee, and that higher-level reviewer will look at the evidence that was before the prior decision-maker and see if he or she can make a different decision or identify an error. And again, we'll process those. Our goal is an average of 125 days. And then finally, veterans that want to appeal to the Board of Veterans Appeals can appeal directly to the board in lieu of going through the Veterans Benefits Administration, for example. That's something that's not available under current law. Allows them to get an immediate review by a veterans law judge. And the goal there is to do those more formal appeals in an average of about 1 year if the veteran selects the fastest route at the board.
Mm-hmm. Now, if we should mention, too, that, that as a result of the new law that's in effect, there's what's called RAMP, which is what this program's called, the Rapid Appeals Modernization Program. Who is eligible for this program? And you've talked about some of the advantages. I'm sure there are probably plenty of them.
Right. We wanted to demonstrate our commitment to veterans that currently have appeals pending. So in your listening area, that's about 18,000 veterans that have an appeal pending right now.
Mm-hmm.
And because their appeal is already pending, the law that goes into effect in February isn't going to help them right away. They're already in this appeal process we have now. What we're doing is we're allowing them through this RAMP program to opt into the new system. They can do that now. All they have to do is file one of those supplemental claims or ask for a higher-level review. And the good news is that there's already about 50,000 veterans that are participating in this program, and they're getting decisions within that 125-day goal that we've set. And we've already paid more than $50 million in retroactive benefits. So the program is working for veterans. We just need help with people such as you to get the word out to veterans to use this program.
We're talking with Dave McClenahan, who is the director of VA's Appeals Management Office, about this new program passed last year in law by Congress and signed by the president on the veterans benefit appeals process. Now, what would happen to a pending appeal if a veteran should decide not to participate in this in RAMP, this new program?
All right. So RAMP is voluntary. We can't force veterans to use it. It's better for them if they do use it, but it is voluntary. So a veteran can choose to stay in the current process, and the vast majority of our resources are on those legacy appeals. We'll continue to work them, and it's our goal to work them down as quickly as we can, but there are inherent delays in the current process. Everybody agrees to that, and that's why the new law was enacted, but we will continue to work those appeals if veterans choose to stay in that process.
Mm-hmm. Now, since this is a new program, how can veterans make a decision on which of the RAMP options might work best for them?
Well, first of all, we always recommend that they consult with their representative if they have one and ask about which choice they should make. But I would like to point out that another key feature of the new system is that veterans really can't make a mistake in choosing an option.
Oh.
What I mean by that is that once they choose one of those two options, supplemental claim or higher level review, and they get a decision, the other options are still available. There's never a penalty that affects the veteran's date that their benefits will start. So that's also good news for veterans. You can't really make a mistake in the new process.
Now, if uh, is people are interested, if veterans in particular and family members we've been listening to this are interested, where can they go if they do have questions about their appeals or maybe some assistance?
Right. So other than talking to their representative,
There
is a lot of information that's available on our website, benefits.va.gov. That includes information on the RAMP program and other initiatives that we have going, and they can find the RAMP election document online that they can send to us to get into the RAMP program.
Well, David, thank you very much for spending time with us to explain this new program. This seems to be, appeals reform seems to be one of the biggest changes that that we've seen come out of the Department of Veterans Affairs in quite some time, and we're glad to see this new program get pushed in and put on fast track, I guess, to put into effect. Thank you for being with us to explain it for us today.
You're welcome. This is one of our highest priorities, and we're looking forward to implementing the law in February.
David McClanahan is the director of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Appeals Management Office. The Indiana Public Defender Commission wants money for a pilot project that could help change the way that parents are defended in court in Department of Child Services cases. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on what the commission is hoping that this pilot program can tell them.
Public defenders often represent parents in DCS court cases, and the proposed pilot project would pair those public defenders with social workers. The Public Defender Commission's Derek Mason says those social workers can help both the parents, who often don't trust DCS social workers, and the public defenders.
Gives the lawyers more knowledge about what services might be alternative to what is being recommended, something their client would be willing to do, to present that to the judge. Lawyers do not have any of this sort of training.
Mason says other states that use this model reunited more children with their parents.
If we just returned 10% of those children home sooner on a yearly basis, you could be saving around $12 million a year.
Mason says the commission is exploring a variety of funding sources for the pilot. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
This week on Shelf Discovery, Kristen tells us about a book about a young woman who was caught up in a Christmas wedding as she's on her way home to visit her family in Cape Town for the holiday.
Plan the stops on your holiday road trips carefully, because this week's discovery ends up stuck in a festive celebration. Thanks for tuning in to this week's Shelf Discovery. I'm your host, Kristen Dreyer Kramer, from nightsandweekends.com. The holiday season is often flooded with emotions, from joy and excitement to heartbreak and anxiety. And in the holiday romance, A Wedding One Christmas, by author Therese Beharry, two strangers who are dreading the holidays end up working through their reservations about the season together. The story stops in a small South African town with Angie Rue, who's reluctantly traveling home to visit her family in Cape Town for Christmas. When she ends up caught up in the middle of a holiday wedding, she ducks into a nearby cafe, where she asks a handsome stranger to be her companion for the day. Ezra Johnson is as smart and as charming as he is handsome, and he seems just as eager to escape the wedding festivities as Angie is, and they soon find themselves building an unexpected connection. Now, with its distinctive setting and holiday adventures, A Wedding One Christmas might have you dreaming of a quirky holiday wedding of your own. This one takes place in a charming town in South Africa in the middle of the town's annual holiday celebrations, which means that the wedding festivities are broken up by holiday parades and improvised Christmas pageants instead of just the usual speeches and dancing. In the middle of all of the merriment, though, the characters struggle with their reservations about both weddings and the holidays. Both are worried about returning home to families who might pass judgment instead of simply enjoying the time together. The holiday anxieties are definitely understandable. But instead of working through their issues while taking in the fun holiday celebrations, the story spends way too much time in the characters' thoughts and debates. A little bit of overthinking can be perfectly reasonable, but page after page after page of it turns what could have been a lovable holiday romance into an exhausting read. But is it worth agonizing over the holidays with these travelers? On a scale of buy it, borrow it, or don't bother, I say don't bother. If you enter the holiday season with a little bit of apprehension, you'll definitely understand the characters. But instead of distracting you with a light, breezy holiday romance, the characters' endless anxieties might just add to your own. Well, it looks like we've come to the last page of this week's Shelf Discovery. A Wedding One Christmas by Therese Beharry is 276 festive but frustrating pages long and is available from Carina Press. For more information, along with show archives and even more reviews, visit shelfdiscovery.org and nightsandweekends.com. And feel free to send any questions, comments, or recommendations my way at books@shelfdiscovery.org. Until next time, wherever the week may take you, don't forget to bring a book.
You can hear Shelf Discovery on Thursdays here on the Lakeshore Public Radio as Kristen Dreyer Kramer offers listeners a peek inside the pages of a new book. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. And our thanks to Sarah Reese and Lauren Cross from The Times, as well as to Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson and Dee Dotson for our stories today. Regionally Speaking is off for Christmas, and we'll be back with you on Wednesday the 26th.